I've selected today's topic for two reasons. Number one, the Luach is such that we are situated between two important mitzvahs of tzedakah, Matanas Avyonim for Purim and Pesach Maos Chitim Kimcha de Pischa. And so kind of tzedakah is a part of our thinking during this month. That's reason number one, and this Agadita, as we'll see, deals with tzedakah in an important and interesting way. The second reason I chose it is because the central figure in this Agadita is Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and you may recall that the last Agadita we did with Rav Shimon ben Chalafta, Rabbi was also a central figure in the Agadita, and so I thought it would be interesting to kind of get another perspective on the great Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So that's the reason for this. Some of you may have learned this Agadita because it appears in the first parak of Bava Basra. So I don't know if you learned that. Have you covered that? Yeah. Did you learn this in Morning Seder? Back in the day? Yeah, back in the day. So it's really part of every standard limud. I don't know to what extent it's ever stressed in a typical shiur in Gemara. I have a feeling that it's kind of like slipped over. So we're doing tshuva for that slipping over a piece of Gemara. So the Gemara reads as follows. Everybody have it? Rebbe Pasach Otz. Actually, I didn't mark it off. Here, let me point to it.
Over here.
Rebbe Pasach in the middle of the daf, pretty much. Pretty much in the middle of the daf. Right after the two dots. It's otherwise known as a colon. In yeshiva, it's always called two dots. I don't know why, but it is called. So everybody have it? Rebbe Pasach, Osros, B'shnei Betzores. Rebbe opened up his storehouses during a period of famine. So that tells you two things. Number one, there was a famine at the time, and there was a period of great distress. And number two, Rebbe was very, very wealthy. And as you know from your previous store of knowledge, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was extremely wealthy. He was the Nasi. He was on a par in some ways. The Gemara describes him as being on a par with wealth as Antoninus, his frequent interlocutor. He often had discussions with Antoninus. Some suggest that he was Marcus Aurelius. Remember? Marcus Aurelius, those of you who took that course with me. Actually might become relevant a little bit later. But anyway, so that's Rebbe. He's giving tzedakah. People are suffering. They don't have enough to eat. So Rebbe opened up his otzaros. Omar, he said, Yichnesu Balei Mikra, Balei Mishnah, Balei Gemara, Balei Halacha, Balei Agoda. Aval Amei Haaretz Al Yichnesu. He invited certain classes of Jews to enter the storehouse and acquire food, but only certain classes and not all. Those that he permitted, and it's interesting, by the way, to look at how Rebbe discriminated against different kinds of learners. There are Balei Mikra. There are people whose expertise is Tanakh. There are Balei Mishnah. There are people whose expertise is mastering the basics of Torah Shebaal Peh as it was transmitted from generation to generation, in which, of course, Rebbe subsequently recorded in a sefer called Mishnah, Mishnayos. But that here is a generic term for everything that was memorized in oral transmission. The basic, Makoros of Halacha, Balei Gemara, are those whose expertise was to derive new halachas from previously transmitted halachas. So there are different sets of skills. Balei Mikra is, more basic and simple. Of course, nowadays, how many people do you know who are a Balei Mikra? There are more people who are Balei Gemara than there are Balei Mikra in contemporary yeshivish world, because people study Gemara, they don't study Mikra. But in those days, it was a more rudimentary basic. Everybody knew Tanakh. Balei Haggadah, Balei Mishnah required a lot of great memory. He had to master memorize vast quanta of halachas. And Balei Gemara are people who not only had mastered those or certain halachas, but they had the mental agility and facility to derive and argue and work out new halachas, which is what our Gemara is. Of course, nowadays, our Gemara is was their Mishnah, in a way. And not just that, but in some ways, the Rishonim have become part of our Mishnah. Because when you approach a sugya, you approach it with the Gemara, and then the classic, you know, Rishonim. So each generation, I would say, probably has its own Mishnah and Gemara, but that's really another discussion. Balei Halacha, that's interesting. So these are the Rabbanim of that period, people who knew Halacha. And I find it interesting that there was a distinction between Balei Gemara in those days and Balei Halacha, because Gemara was really Halacha Lamaisa, and they were trying to figure out what to do. In many ways. So there were people whose expertise was, I guess, the application of these principles to daily life. But the Gemara is full of that. I mean, if you look at our Gemara, it's full of these things, right? So I find it interesting. I'm not quite sure what to make of it, and it's probably worthy of further reflection and research.
Could it be like this between like theoreticians and
applied? Yeah, applied. In fact, the Gemara, as we have it, is so applied in many ways, and trying to figure out all kinds of different halachas. I mean, nowadays we might distinguish between somebody who's a lamdan and somebody who's a posek, and those are very, very significant distinctions today. Somebody would be a great lamdan and know a lot about, you know, the lamdas, brisker lamdas and kutchim, but he doesn't know what to do if your Shabbos lech goes out or something. You know, he doesn't know the practicalities. In fact, in classic Litvish yeshivas, being a Baal Halacha was a step down. Can't be a lamdan, so you need to know the practical halacha. It was looked at pejoratively. It's worth figuring out, knowing more about what Rabbi Yehuda Nasi meant by this distinction. And I just sort of leave it to your research or reflection. It's not that germane to our Agadata. What really is germane, though, is that the next one, Balei Hagada. So the Gemara actually. There are other sources amongst the Tanayim who indicate that there are these specialties. And amongst them, there were Balei Haggadah, people who specialize in Haggadah. Like those, if you only learned, you only came to this Haggadah this year, and you didn't do anything else, and you would be one of the Balei Haggadah, you wouldn't be one of the, maybe they did other things too, but that would be your specialty. I remember there's a Gemara that says, Rabbi Akiva, Klach Etzel Tyrus. You know, your specialty is Tyrus. Don't bother me with, you know, Haggadah or Dreshes. The different Tanayim and Amoraim had specialties, so there were these different specialties. I find it interesting. We didn't think that, you know, there was this monolithic Talmidei Chachamim, the Tanayim and Amoraim were all monolithic. But just like today, we have people with different interests, different specialties. So too, in those days, they had different interests and specialties as well. In any case, the crucial next piece is that Amei Aretz were not permitted to enter into take food. Now that's pretty striking. Raises a number of questions, like, what were they supposed to die of starvation? Like, what was Rabbi Yehuda Nasi saying? Well, I don't care if they die, they're only Am HaAretz, so let them die of starvation in the street. Is that like what Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was saying? Seems unlikely on the face of it, right? Possible. So the Ritva discusses this. If you look at Chidushi Ritva on Bava Basra, you know, there's a whole Chidushi Ritva on Bava Basra, so he talks about this in Gemara too. And he says, no, that Rebbe didn't intend that Amei Aretz should die of starvation. Rebbe assumed that if they didn't get food from his Otsaros, they would get food from some other sources. They would go to some other community, some other area where there was food to be found. He didn't really condemn them to death. That would be extremely harsh. And as the poskim and as the mefarshim point out, the halacha is you're supposed to be mefarnes aniye akum. During a period of famine, that every Jew is obligated to give not only to other Jews but to akum as well. What's the reason for that? One could think of different reasons. Mishum Eiv is one possibility. What's that? Darkei Shalom. Yes, right. You know, that they're human beings and we need to. Depends on how you understand Darkei Shalom. It's a whole other discussion, which I'm not going to get into right now. But is an obligation to feed Akum, so Allah is kama v'kama, there should be an obligation to feed Amei Aretz who are Jews. So, like, how is that, what is that supposed to mean? So, like the Rashi points out, this halacha about Akum. So how is it possible? So the Ritva is what I said. The Marsha has his own approach. I'd like the Ritva personally a little better than the Marsha, but you tell me what you think. The Marsha says that during a period of famine or a period of general distress in life, so even those who aren't suffering from that much distress should share in the distress of others. And so, as you know, there's an isser of tashmish hamita during a period of a famine, because during, when people are suffering, people can't shouldn't be taking pleasure in their life. It's a general time of pain, and if you engage in activities that are joyous and pleasurable, you're demonstrating an insensitivity to the larger human condition, which is a wrong thing to do. So therefore, the Marsha says, Rebbe was afraid, these are Amei Aretz, if they get some food, they're going to live it up. They're not going to be a no seba ol and chavero. They're not going to feel the tsar of others. And he didn't want to promote that. So therefore, he wanted to make sure that they also would suffer, that they would not, you know, indulge in any pleasures inappropriately. That's the Marsha's approach. I tend to think the Ritva's a little bit closer to the Peshad. I don't know if that's... So one question to ask is, why this animus towards Amei Aretz, though? Like, let's assume, like the Ritva, that he didn't mean to starve them. But why is he not allowing them to go into the Otsa? Like, why this tremendous animosity towards Amei Aretz? It reflects really a harsh class system in the times of the Tanaim, or at least for Rebbe. They were the Amei Aretz, and they were like everybody else. Notice, by the way, that there's a binary opposition. Either you will a Baal, Mikra, Mishnah, Gemara, Halacha, Haggadah, Baal, or you were a nincompoop. Like, maybe you aren't a Baal Halacha, but, you know, you learn Mishnah Berurah, Mishnah Berurah Yomi, you do Dirshu, you know some stuff. It's not like you don't know anything. Isn't it interesting that the Gemara portrays it as a binary opposition? Either you are a Baal something, or you are a total ignoramus, total ignorance. That doesn't reflect, I think, our contemporary reality, but apparently it did reflect the reality of Chazal during the Tanaim, that either you were with it, or you were an ignorance. They didn't have, apparently there wasn't much in between. And that really raises the question of who were these Amei Aretz and why did Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi have such animus towards them. So this might recall for you a famous statement that Rabbi Akiva made. Rabbi Akiva started out life as an Amei Aretz, you may recall, and then over many years he became the great Godel that he became. But he says, when I was an Amei Aretz, I would anashchenu k'chamor. If I found a Talmid Chacham, I would bite him like a donkey. The Gemara says, what about a dog? Why not bite him like a dog? The bite of a donkey is far worse, the Gemara says. There was a tremendous mutual animosity between those who were in the orbit of those who learned, Talmid Chachamim, and those who were Amei Aretz. It wasn't just like they were ignorant. It's that they hated the Talmidei Chachamim. And the Chachamim reciprocated. You know, they hate us, they hate Torah. They don't want to be, you know, they're not with the program of learning of with we the way we understand Avodas HaKodesh should be. So they're not Me'an Shei Shlomeinu. They were really a caste apart. It's really like a caste system. So where do you think this comes from? Like, how do you understand this? Have you ever encountered this before? I mean, thought about it? It's a very interesting phenomenon during the period of Chazal. There was such... in fact, one Taisvis, I forgot where, says that some of the Talmidei Chachamim were somewhat arrogant sometimes towards the Amei Aretz because they were such ignoramuses. But it wasn't just they were ignoramuses. They seemed to, like judging from what Rabbi Akiva said, they couldn't stand Talmidei Chachamim. I see echoes of this in like attitudes towards people in Kol El on the part of some balabatim in the community, certainly in Israel, where the army is this huge gap between the Haredi world and everybody else. There is considerable animus on the part of many chilonim, not all, many chilonim towards those who sit in Kol and learn. Say partially that's because they're on the dole and they're not working and they don't serve in the army, but there's real animosity on the part of many towards those in Kol El in Israel.
Is it about being Machshav Torah?
On the part of the Amiorites and not Machshav Torah? I think that's a part of it, but there is this, you experience it today. Even not Eretz Yisrael, you certainly experience it, but even today there are people who are very negative about guys learning a Kol El. Bench burners, you know, bench warmers, not doing anything with their lives, they should go out and get a job and do something. Have you heard that?
I used to say that when he was growing up, the idea of being a bench fetcher was such a pejorative kind of way.
Right, the norm was to be a balabas. It's interesting what my wife, when I got married many years ago, so I was coming out of the yeshiva world, and my wife, certainly not coming out of the yeshiva world, was coming from more Heimisha world in Borough Park. So we used the term balabas in antithetical ways, unknowingly. Like for a yeshivish guy, balabas is, you know, someone who doesn't learn, maybe a little daf yomi here and there, but you know, he's not a real into it. And on the other hand, in the more Heimish world, a balabas was like an expression of praise. He's balabatish, he does things right, he's appropriate. So the same phrase can have diametrically opposed connotations depending upon the culture from which you emerge. And, you know, it's not like we were totally disparate cultures. My wife went to Beis Yaakov. I mean, you know, my parents worked. It wasn't like we were different worlds, but it's interesting. In any case, that sort of relates to this whole Am Haaretz issue. The Am Haaretz, just like, you know, you were saying, Rabbi Parnas was saying, there was a real negativity to his learning, a similar attitude then. Now, the difference is many Tanayim worked. So it wasn't as if they were bench warmers. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them worked. So that gap wasn't there. But there was clearly a huge gap in Chashivas HaTorah, in valuing Torah learning. And the Amiorites just simply, they also weren't careful in many halachas. Tumah v'Taira, for example, Trumas, they weren't careful about. So they were not careful in certain halakhas, and they looked pejoratively at people who had that extra care. It's a little bit, maybe, in some ways you might say, like an ill-educated, this is maybe a bad example, but I'll just throw it out there, like an ill-educated conservative Jew who, you know, thinks these Orthodox Jews are just, like, weird. They may, you know, they may do keep some traditions, Shabbos and stuff. Amiorites kept more than a typical conservative Jew did. But that same tension you would find a little bit today on the part of some conservative Jews who think Orthodox Jews are totally off the wall. Or modern Orthodox Jews, by the way, towards people who are, you know, very, very Haredi. These tensions still echo into our life. Be all that as it may, it's pretty clear that there was a lot of antipathy between the Talmidei Chachamim, Chaverim as they were called, and the Am Haaretz. It was religious, it was social, it was economic sometimes, these tensions. So, Rebbe excludes them from any parnassa. So, Dachak Rebbe Yonasan ben Amram v'nichnas. Rebbe Yonasan ben Amram pushed his way into the Otsar, where Rebbe was. This is, he pushed himself. So there's physicality here. He shtupped himself in, as they say in Yiddish, he like pushed himself in. V'nichnas, and he said, Amala, v'nichnas, he went in. Amala, he said, Rebbe Parnaseni, Rebbe, please provide me with Parnasa. Amar lo, he said to him, Bni, Karisa, my son, did you learn Mikra? Amar lo, he said, no, Lav. Amar lo, he said to him, Lav, no. Shanisa, did you learn Mishnah? Amar lo, Lav, no. Imkein b'ma'a farnasech. If so, on what basis should I provide you with a parnasa? So before we look at his answer, first of all, notice that the categories have gotten slimmed down from Mikra, Mishnah, Haggadah, etc., Halacha, to Mikra and Mishnah. Why do you think that is the case? What's that?
I didn't have that.
Right. Those are the two most basics. Mikra and Mishnah. If he didn't have any knowledge of Tanakh or basic Torah Shabbat Peh, then he's not likely to have had anything else. It's like saying, you know, if you haven't learned pre-calculus, I don't need to ask you about differential equations. It's obvious you don't know differential equations if you haven't studied pre-calculus. So, putting it in an academic context. So that's what he was saying. Now notice he calls him Bini, my son. What does that tell you? He doesn't know him, apparently. But why does he call him Bini? Exactly. It's a term of endearment. Rebbe is... You might get this picture of Rebbe as harsh. No Ami Aretz. Don't even bother coming. But Rebbe is portrayed here as somebody who is compassionate and concerned and wants to welcome a prospective person who is poor. Bini, my son. He calls him his son. As a Nasi, leader of the Jewish community, in some sense, every member of the community was a child for whom Rebbe was responsible as the leader of the community. And he is projected here not merely as, you know, a political boss, but as a father, a loving father of the impoverished Jews around him, which is part of the impetus behind his opening up his storehouses. He has all these children, and he cares about them, and he wants to support them, which is a very touching, I think, image of Rebbe, which is conveyed by calling him Bini. Yes?
I'm just noticing the Lashon Diyuk when he asks him, you know, like, how can I give you parnasa? So mad, like, with what? Like, almost to say, like, I just don't have the means.
Great, perfect. We've been learning together too long, Josh, because that's exactly, we're going to make exactly that point. It's great. Wonderful, really wonderful observation. That carries forward. He said, I'd love to help you. I really want to be fairness to you. Just give me some basis to do so. I need some basis. If you're not Boris, I'm sorry I can't do it, but I want to work with you. It's like, you know, a teacher will say, you know, you have a professor and a student comes in and he asks questions and he says, just give me something to work with. I'll help you. I'll tutor you. And I'll provide you extra reading material. Just come to my office and I'll talk to you. I'll work with you. Bini, Parnasani, no, well, you know, I don't know much, but then what can I work? How can I help you? I want something. He wants a basis to provide him support. It's not like looking to shove him away. He's looking to be Makarit, which is very interesting. Yes?
I know nowadays the title rabbi might be more loosely or commonly used, but in times of tomorrow, this time, they call him Rebbe, and then he goes to our Aram.
Terrific.
Is that more...
Terrific point, Ellie. Also, we've been learning Shiurim together. I say, you know, we're beginning to think alike. That's correct. It turns out that this is all, he's an imposter. He really is a Rebbe. It turns out that he was a student of Rebbe, who either Rebbe didn't know all of his Talmidim, because maybe he had a very big yeshiva, or he may have disguised himself. He may have come... you know, people often wore their face head covered. They were ma'atef themselves. He may have been unrecognizable. But he was an imposter. He was really a Talmud Chacham. And the Gemara, as Ellie, you know, astutely observed, the Gemara is telegraphing, even to the reader at the very beginning, this is not like just Yonason. This is Rebbe Yonason. Rebbe, you know, Nasi, does not know that. But we, the reader of this Gemara, know more than Rebbe does about this, the true identity of this mysterious man who comes in asking for Parnassa. And so, that begs the question, like, why did he do this? Presumably he was poor, he needed money, but why is he an imposter? Why is he making believe that he is ignorant? What?
Chinese point.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think there is a role reversal here. Rebbe is Rebbe. Rebbe Yonah's son, Talmud. Now, Rebbe Yonah's son wants to be the Rebbe of Rebbe. Rebbe Yonah's son feels that he needs to teach Rebbe something. Now, we can't teach Rebbe something. Rebbe is the Gadol Hadar. But he can create circumstances whereby Rebbe will rethink his stance towards Am Yaretz. Look, what is his answer to him? How shall I provide you with a parnasa? He says, Parnaseni kekelev uka orev. Support me like a kelev and an orev. I am no worse than a dog or a raven. Now, what's so special about a dog and a raven for starters? So let's look at Rashi. You see Rashi, kelev ka'orev? How's Rashi? Rashi says, Shachas HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleihem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has rachmanis on a dog and an orev. Shenemar Yodea Tzadik Din Dalim. Tzadik knows the judgment of the poor. Lefish HaKelev Mizonosav Mu'otim. Dog doesn't have much to eat. That is not the case of dogs today. Dogs are rolling in luxury, having dogs who are pets. In those days, dogs were not frequently pets, and so they kind of roamed around searching for food, and they had very, very little to eat. It's a little bit like the cats of Yerushalayim. All these cats running all over the place, going into the garbages. Those are the dogs of those days. Lefikach shoa achilosa v'mei av shloshes yamin. Maris asserts that food remains in his digestive system for 3 days so as to provide the dog with nutrients, even if he can't eat regularly. V'gabe orev ksiv l'vnei orev asher yikro lefishach orev achzori al banav. Since a raven is cruel towards his children, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mazman lehem yitushim mitoch tzo'asam v'ochlin. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides for the baby ravens by providing little bugs inside their excrement so that they have something to eat. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu has rachmanis on dogs and ravens, and what he's saying is, I am no worse than a dog. If just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides for dogs, ravens, so too you should provide for me. In other words, he is arguing or implying that the distinction between Am Haaretz and anybody else is simply inappropriate to the circumstances of famine. I am no worse than a kelev and an orev. So what happens? Parnasay. Rebbe changes his mind. Now, does this remind you of anything that we had in the last Agadot about Rebbe? Who remembers? If you can think back to 2 weeks ago. What did Rebbe do? What?
He was confronted by
the wife of Shimon ben Chalafta. And what happens? Hodela. He admitted that she's right. This is an element of the exceptional godless of Rebbe. That when he comes to believe that he's wrong, he just admits it. That's an amazing thing. There it was admitting he was wrong before an anonymous wife, a woman who was lower on the totem pole in those days than today. And here he admits, or he reverses himself, after confronting an anonymous, impoverished man whom he doesn't know. It's truly impressive. And we're going to see that this continues to evolve. It's very, very interesting. So why did he change his mind? Why does he change his mind?
He realizes he's right.
Excuse me?
He realizes he's right. And he should ask the fear.
I don't think so. Let me read another line or two to give you a sense of why I don't think that's right and what's at stake here. Basad Nafik, after Rabbi Yonason goes out, Yosef Rebbe v'kametz dayer. Rebbe is sitting and he's upset. The Amar, and he said, Oy li shenasati piti li Am Haaretz. woe unto me, I gave my bread to an Amor. So he regrets what he just did. So if he were convinced that this Ani was right, Rabbi Yonasan was right, why would he regret it? What's this? We can track the evolution of Rebbe's stance. There's Rebbe 1, no Ami Aretz. Rebbe 2, where he parnasei, he gives him. Rebbe 3, where he regrets having given him this food. So if he was persuaded by Rabbi Yonasan's argument, then why would he have regretted having given him in the first place? Which leads me to believe that Rebbe gave him out of sheer moral sentiment. Morality comes in different versions or different stripes. There is moral behavior driven by principle, and there is moral behavior driven by sheer feeling. There was a famous philosopher by the name of David Hume who maintained that all moral behavior is a matter of sentiment. There is no such thing as moral principle. Not a widespread view, but famous for articulating it. But what seems to have happened here is Rebbe broke down in, you know, his principles. He has principles. Don't give to an Amaretz. I forgot to mention, the Gemara says, call me she'en bodeya asa l'rachim. It's asa to have rachmanis on somebody who rejects what Torah stands for. So he has a principle. Somebody who is an Amaretz should not get support. But now he breaks down. I feel so bad for this guy. He's poor. He's starving. He doesn't have food for his kids. He gives him. But he gives out of emotion. And then afterwards he says, but why should my emotions drive my behavior? Emotions contaminate my behavior. Emotions obfuscate my principles. I have certain principles. I have certain convictions. Call me she'ein bodeya asal rachamala. I shouldn't give to an Amaretz. And now, you know, I succumb to my rachmanis. But that's the wrong thing to do. My decisions about tzedakah and who I give tzedakah to should always and only be determined by my principles as to who is or is not deserving of tzedakah. He regards himself as being a traitor to his principles. And what made him a traitor to his principles is the weakness of giving in to his emotions. Now, we usually think of giving in to your emotions as maybe negative. Like you're angry at somebody, you feel angry, and you give in to your emotions and you vent your anger. Right? So we usually think of emotions as being negative. But here you have a fascinating case of emotions that we would regard as positive, compassion, and yet for a deeply principled person, should one ever allow one's emotions to drive one's decisions? Does this ring a bell to any of you who took any of my courses? Ellie?
Stoicism.
Good! Stoicism! That's correct. The Stoics took the view that emotions are dangerous, they destabilize, and a person should make all decisions only on the basis of what he thinks is right. Now, who was Rebbe's close friend? Antoninus. Now, I don't know that Antoninus was Marcus Aurelius. Some people think he was. But he was of that school. It wouldn't surprise me if he and his interlocutor shared a worldview for which reason they were good buddies. And why were they so friendly? You wouldn't be so friendly with somebody if you had radically different ways of looking at the world. That would be pretty surprising. Now, obviously, Antoninus was a pagan. Rebbe was Rebbe HaKadosh. But there was a certain safa mishutefet, a certain set of perspectives of the world which they may have shared. This is just conjecture. I don't know. This may have been Rebbe's. But it's just interesting to me, given, you know, that what we know about the history and about Rebbe's interlocutors and about Marcus Aurelius and that school, it's kind of interesting that they both shared, apparently, this is the way I read the Gemara, shared the view that emotions are destabilizing and should never be the mainspring for choice. Even if we might say, oh, the emotions, they're positive. It's Rachmanis. It's good to have Rachmanis. No, Rachmanis is not good. Call me she'ein bodeya asur l'rachim olam. What does that say? That there are people for whom you should not have compassion. What's the the example from that in the Torah, Tanakh. Famous example. Shaul and Agag, exactly correct. Shaul and Agag. Shaul had Rachmanis and Agag, and that Rachmanis was wrong. Somebody who is an Amaleki, there should be no Rachmanis. He's an awful guy. Don't allow your emotions, even good emotions. Rachmanis is a good emotion. You should cultivate it. But Rebbe is saying there are limits to the role that emotion should play in choice, and Rebbe is now rejects his compassion that he felt. So there's Rebbe 1, principle, Rebbe 2, emotion, Rebbe 3, rejection of emotion on the basis that it's a failure of reason. Reason should drive choice, and that emotion was a failure. So, this whole sugya so far really recapitulates the Gemara in Bava Metzia Daf Pei Hei Amud Aleph. Very, very well-known Gemara. You probably all know about it. As you may recollect, Rebbe was subject to intense Yisurin in his life. He suffered from great, great gastrointestinal distress. Rare, terrible, terrible pains. He would yell so loud when he had to go to the bathroom that it would echo. He had terrible, terrible Yisurin. So the Gemara there offers an explanation for why he had those Yisurin and then why the Yisurin were eventually relieved. It's a very famous Agadita. Who remembers why Rebbe had these Yisurin? Anybody remember? Okay, I'm sure as soon as I start telling you, you'll remember. There was a calf on the way to Shechita. And this calf nuzzled its head into Rebbe's coat and started crying. You know, like mooing, I guess, in a kind of a sad way. Cows cried, but mooing in a way that we human beings would interpret to be an expression of sadness. And then Rebbe says, Kila kach no tzarta, what are you complaining about? Your function in creation is to be slaughtered so that people could eat you, and that's your role in creation. That is a picture of the world which is cognitively driven. Every creature in the world has a function. Human beings have their function, chairs have its function, you know, cats have their function, dogs, cows, insects. There is this incredibly complex ecology of the world, a kind of a moral or religious ecology of the world, which every single creature has its role. Hashem created the world in that way. Did he say we can't eat animals? No. In fact, when it comes to karbanos, it's a chiyuv to sheft animals. So Rebbe obviously was not a vegetarian, and he understood that his view was that Hashem created animals for purposes of being eaten, or using their skin for leather, so they have shoes, or what have you. So Rebbe took a very, you might say, principled, theological picture of the way the world should be, theologically driven. Gilakach no tzarta, Hashem created you for a purpose. So there's a theological framework, it's principled, and that, Chazal say, is what led to his terrible Yisurim. Because he showed no rachmanis on this poor old crying cow nuzzling its moaning face into his coat. And many years later, he was cured because his maid was cleaning up a room and she came upon a nest of chuldos. Not clear what that is. Some say rats, some say polecats. I'm not sure. Some kind of, what's the name for that kind of animal? What's that? Rodent? You're kind of a rodent. It's kind of a rodent. And she wanted to throw them out, and he told her to leave them alone, v'rachamav al kol ma'asa, because Hashem has rachmanis on all of his creatures, including these creatures. He got cured. He put you out of business. So, what's going on here? What's first there is Rebbe 1, principle, right? Theological picture of the world, where every creature has its role, including being killed. Then there is a progression beyond that to what we might say Rebbe II, compassion. He has Rachmanis, which cured him. But now, at this phase, or at least in this encounter, which is not animals, it's human beings, there is now a Rebbe III who is regretting his Rebbe II phase. Is that clear, everybody? Okay, so let's see how it Haggadah continues. Amar Lefanav Rebbe Shimon bar Rebbe. Rebbe Shimon bar Rebbe says to Rebbe. Rebbe Shimon bar Rebbe is the son of Rebbe. So we have the impostering Rebbe Yonasan. Yonasan, Rabbi Yonasan, as Ellie pointed out. And now we have another subgenerational figure. Rebbe, Talmud, Yonasan. Rebbe, son. It's almost as if this is such an intergenerational effort on the part of the younger generation to, I don't know if I want to use the word educate, but to influence the older generation. First Talmud, then son. Amar Lefanav Rebbe Shimon bar Rebbe. Shema Yonasan ben Amram Talmidechahu? Maybe Yonasan ben Amram is your student. She'eino rotza lehanos mikavod haTorah. Miyamba. Maybe he really is knowledgeable. But he refused to exploit his knowledge of Torah for pecuniary purposes. He didn't want to derive material benefit from his knowledge of Torah, because that is to make the Torah kardom lachbarba. It's to use the Torah. Torah is an end in itself. It is never a means to another end. For Torah to be a means to another end, it's to assert that there is a higher end, which is superior to Torah, to which Torah is a means. That is to abase Torah. And that's the Mishnah in Perkei Avos. And Rabbi Shimon Berebi is suggesting this. Now, he's not saying it is the case. He's saying maybe it's the case. So it's a very delicate and... So the Gemara continues. Bodko vi ashkach. So they checked and discovered that he was as truly as Talmud. Question. Why didn't Rabbi Yonasan check before he made this conjecture? Oh, yeah, I don't know if Rebbe checked, but he wanted to be sensitive to how he presented it to Rebbe. He didn't want to, like, hit raise his father. He didn't want to put it over the head. Oh, he's your Talmud, what are you doing? He's a Talmud Chacham. He wanted to maybe. It's like a, you know, more gentler way of posing a possibility to Rebbe, not crashing him over the head with this information. Let's go check it out. Which, of course, happens, and he is the Talmud. So it's clear that Rabbi Yonasan is an imposter. Yes, Josh.
Also, Shimon doesn't say, oh, this is Rabbi Yonasan ben Amram trying to teach you a lesson. He says, this is Rabbi Yonasan ben Amram with his own chumrah. Kind of like, oh, like, why would Rabbi Yonasan do such a thing? Because maybe he has a, he's mocking
right.
himself, he doesn't want to benefit.
Right.
Not like he's trying to send you a message.
Okay, all right, okay, that's a good point. Okay, so it turns out that's the case. So what do you think Rebbe's response would be? Let him come in. Right? Okay, it's Talmud Chacham. I made a mistake. Rebbe is very a godol. Remember, Bishameis Rebbe, when Rebbe died, with him was Niftar Yiras Ched and Anava. This is another example of Rebbe's Anava. So, okay, I made a mistake. Let him come in. That's not what he says. Look at the Gemara. That's not what he says. What Rebbe says is, okay, yiknesu hakol. Now everybody goes in. Rebbe has completely retracted his initial stance to discriminate amongst Balei Mishnah, Balei Mikra, Balei Agada, Balei Halacha, Edamei Arts. Everybody goes in. he indiscriminately opens his storehouses to every single poor Jew. That, why is that, how does that follow from the divulging the true identity of Yonah's son, Rebbe Yonah's son, so then he should let Rebbe Yonah's son in? Why does he retract entirely and reverse his whole stance? That's one of the key questions in the Agadita. But before I try to answer that, this is Rebbe number 4, right? Look at how Rebbe evolves. That's very impressive. Most people that I know never change their mind. I'm sure I'm right, of course. What a gadol Rebbe is. He's, you know, he reflects things, he responds to circumstances. He is not a dogmatist. It's just so impressive. I mean, the Gemara tracks the evolution of Rebbe's development over time, which, I, as I say, to me is such a Musar Haskel. The Gadol Hadar, the man who compiled the Mishnah, the Nasi. And he just is open to change and reflection and adaptation. I find that to be really, really impressive. But in any case, back to my question, why does he reverse his whole position? So, there are two approaches of which I'm aware. One is my own, which I will share with you second. And the first approach I saw in an essay by a man by the name of Shmuel Faust, who wrote on this Agadita. And he proposes the following suggestion, which I think is not a bad one, although you'll see if you prefer mine to his. But his suggestion is that Rebbe's approach led Talmidei Chachamim to benefit from their Torah knowledge. Now, there's Rebbe saying, unless you're Talmid Chacham, unless you've learned, you can't come in. So that means that every person who's a Talmid Chacham has to cash in on his learning in order to secure Parnassa. So in fact, Rebbe is putting everybody in a position of abusing Torah. Now, every person has to say, you know, I learned, so I deserve it. So every person is, right, as a result of, which I think is a good explanation. You with me? You clear? Josh? Yeah? Okay, I think it's a good explanation. Okay, I will suggest another explanation, which is that I'm intrigued by Rebbe Yonah. In general, I'm intrigued by people who will disguise themselves, who are imposters. I find them intriguing figures. And building on that, maybe what Rebbe came to understand is that human beings are fundamentally unknowable. We can never really know the truth about somebody else. There's a guy in your shir who seems like he's confident and smart and a big lamdan, but he is suffering from the worst anxiety you can imagine, but he just covers it up. There is this person who looks really, you know, dresses really well with very expensive clothing and has a fancy car, but is really coming from a very, very poor and background, is trying to cover it up. And so somehow or other he gets hand-me-downs from somebody else and he borrows a car, so he looks like he's more comfortable, but in fact he's not. Just to say that human beings often mask themselves in many different ways. Sometimes those masks are, in psychology, called defense mechanisms. A defense mechanism is a mask. You know, you kind of protect, you cover yourself. You don't want people to know what's truly going on. And all of us, by the way, I don't think a single person doesn't mask him or herself to some extent. You don't want to be totally open about what you're feeling, what you're thinking, your anxieties, you're being depressed, or your whatever your issues are. You don't want to share that with everybody. But imagine what society would be like if everybody were consistently appearing on Oprah Winfrey, you know, and divulging their guts. You know, society would be dysfunctional, and people can't live that way. And so it is normal and appropriate to some extent to put a mask over ourselves so that nobody knows everything that's truly going on inside. Let's say, you know, somebody's married, they had an argument with your wife, and you're really upset. You want everybody to know that? No, there's certain things you keep private. That's the way it is, and that is, it's healthy to some extent. Of course, when you're speaking to somebody with whom you're very, very close, like a wife or a husband or a really close friend or maybe parents or a Rebbe if you're very close, it's appropriate to be open. Otherwise, how can you ever grow and evolve? But it is the norm for human beings to all wear masks on occasion. Isn't that true? Look at me, isn't that true? Aren't we all wearing masks sometimes? And so Rebbe discovered that there is no way to penetrate, for him to penetrate beyond the omnipresent mask that every human being wears. He thought that this guy was some poor Amoritz. Turns out that he was his Talmud. He was Rebbe Yonason and not Yonason. And Rebbe didn't get that. And so what Rebbe discovered is a profound insight into the human condition, which is that human beings are fundamentally mysterious and enigmatic, and it is wrong for him, b'shas betzores, in a time of famine and of great need, to start making judgments. Don't make judgments! Do you really know who an Amoritz is? Do you really know who a Talmud Chacham? Maybe this guy seems like a Talmud Chacham, but he asked a good kasha once in yeshiva, so he got a good reputation, but he doesn't know in Aleph and Beis. But people think he's not. You've probably met people like that, you know, people who appear to be with it and learn it, but in fact, you know, they're really Amoritz. Probably met people like that. How can we really tell? You give everybody a bechino all the time? At the end of the day, the human condition is fundamentally masked and mysterious. And Rebbe discovered that in times of exigency and crisis, where life and death is at stake, one needs to respect the mask of the human condition to recognize one's limitations and ever penetrating it, and therefore to open the otsaros to all. So this is a radical revision in Rebbe's understanding of himself, of tzedakah, and the world around him. Rebbe thought he could figure it out. He could know who's this, who's that, who's deserving, who's not deserving. And Rebbe came, through the impostering of Rabbi Yonason, came to understand that that was a false assumption. And that in times of great need, who is Rebbe to figure out, even the Gadol Hadar of Rebbe, figure out what people are truly like? And it's a lesson, I think, to all of us to remember that human beings are masked. We should be careful about judgments we make about them. We really don't know other people. We need to make judgments. You can't go through life without making judgments about people. I do it all the time, as a dean, as a professor, as a rabbi. You know, and you do it all the time too. You can't function in society without making some judgment about people. So one takeaway for me is that every judgment that you make should be very, very consciously tentative. Be tentative. Recognize that at the end of the day, human beings are fundamentally mysterious. You can never penetrate to their depths. And in crucial decisions, respect the mystery of the human condition.
Maybe this is reflected in Rashi, in Pasuk, Rashi quotes from Mishlei. One of the critiques on Rebbe is, who is he to judge? And yet, it's maybe only a Kodesh Baruch Hu to whom we could see, like, maybe one, the human perspective, look at the dog and Oreb as these cruel, unworthy creatures under the sustenance.
Right, only Hashem. Okay, very good. Excellent. Okay.